Okay, I'd certainly agree. Do you want me to repeat questions for the tape? Okay, the question is concerning the executive orders. Okay, we don't need to repeat the questions then. What about executive orders? Do they violate the Constitution? I'd have to say that it depends on what subject matter they concern. Yes, obviously a president has to issue orders from time to time. Washington did, and that's been true all throughout American history. Executive orders are a fact of life, and we couldn't run a government without it. But there are certain things I am being told, although I can't really say I've checked these out, but I'm told, for example, there are executive orders that provide for the detention of persons during a time of national emergency, and have even established certain camps or institutions which could be called concentration camps, so that could be done. Many other things done in the name of executive orders. And one of the reasons for this seems to be that whereas treaties and statutes have to go through Congress, an executive order does not. And so sometimes an executive order can be an attempt to get something done that could not be done by the traditional constitutional route of treaties or acts of Congress. I think in determining whether or not an executive order violates the Constitution, we have to look at what its real purpose is. And if it's to do something that could not be done by a traditional means, then I'd say, yes, it is definitely unconstitutional. Okay, go ahead. Is your next?
Before I ask my question, I just want to say that I really enjoyed the conference, and thank you for coming to Pullman.
Well, thank you. I might just say something here, too. I have never in all my life come to the church where I felt I got such red carpet or blue carpet treatment as I received here. Nor have I been to a conference where I felt things were as organized to a T as you've had them here. And, Rod, whoever you managed to get to handle that for you must have really done a great job. But, okay, go ahead with your question.
I'll say, too, I'm a member of Abundant Life Fellowship from Palouse, and we're looking forward to having you tomorrow. So I hope that we can treat you as well as they have here at LFM.
Well, thank you.
In a magazine up here at the library, WC Library, they have a magazine called The Atheist Journal or something like that. And they were there was an article about an atheist bookstore that they had opened at Denver, Colorado, and they had a picture in there of the inside interior of the bookstore. And on the walls they have plaques of quotations. And I had run across, this was two or three months ago, I had run across these quotations of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, and I was wondering if they were accurate, and if they were, if you could share the context of the quotations. One was, "I do not find in Christianity one redeeming feature," by Thomas Jefferson. The other one is, "This would be the best of all worlds if there were no religion in it," by John Adams. And so he would take it from there.
Okay, thank you. The two questions concerning statements by Jefferson and by Adams. I think probably the statement from Jefferson, if it is an accurate statement, would come from earlier in his life. I had not run across that particular statement. But early in Jefferson's life, he became very disillusioned with Christianity. Part of the reason, there were two reasons really. One was his opposition to the Calvinists and to the Calvinistic emphasis on predestination, on election, and the de-emphasis of free will. You remember that Jefferson declared in the Memorial and Remonstrance on Religion, if I recall correctly, "Almighty God hath created the mind free." I believe that's out of the Bill of Rights, not the Remonstrance. But Jefferson believed very strongly in human reason and human free will. And for that reason, he was very much opposed to Calvinism, which he regarded as a very intolerant system. In fact, he even said about Calvin that Calvin was an atheist. Now, here's what he meant by that. Jefferson believed that anything to be real must be somewhat material. In other words, there's nothing purely spiritual. God must be, to some extent, a material being. There must be, even in the soul and spirit, there's got to be some material essence to it. Now, Calvin, talking about God as being wholly spiritual, well, if that's the case, then God is absurd. He doesn't exist. And so he called Calvin, on the one hand, an atheist, and on the other hand, he called Calvin a demon worshiper, since only a demon could do the things that Calvin ascribed to God, the double predestination of sending people to hell, and so on. Well, that was Jefferson's earlier view in life, and at that time, he seemed to have a very negative attitude toward Christianity. But as Jefferson grew older, he gradually changed his views, and part of the reason he changed them, I'm not entirely comfortable with this, but he began to read some of the religious liberals of the day, like Bolingbroke and Priestley and others, who were more or less, than they called themselves Christians, or were really more probably Unitarian. And he decided at that point, well, if That's what a Christian is, then I can be a Christian. And at one point in his life, he called himself. He said, this is it later in life, I am a real Christian. But he used a different definition of Christian in that sense from the way we would probably define Christian today. I'm looking for a statement here. Here's what Jefferson says about Jesus Christ. And let's see, the date of this statement would be 1803, a letter to Dr. Joseph Priestley, an English theologian. He says of Jesus, his system of morality was the most benevolent and sublime probably that has ever been taught, and consequently the more perfect than those of any of the ancient philosophers. He was the most innocent, the most benevolent, the most eloquent and sublime character that ever has been exhibited to man. And he goes on to say in another statement, I consider the moral precepts of Jesus as more pure, correct, and sublime than those of the ancient philosophers. Well, then he goes on to talk a lot more about Jesus. I won't read you everything he says here, but as to what he thought about religion in general, I can just quote a couple statements here. I'm looking for something in particular, and excuse me if I'm a little bit... Here's a statement he made in 1816 in a letter to Charles Thompson. I am a real Christian. That is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus. Very different from the Platonists who call me infidel and themselves Christians and preachers of the gospel. He goes on to say in another statement, well, I'll read you a statement of his particular grandson. Of his particular religious opinions, his family knew no more than the world. If asked by one of them of his opinion on any religious subject, his uniform reply was that it was a subject each was bound to study assiduously for himself, unbiased by the opinions of others. It was a matter solely of conscience. After thorough investigation, they were responsible for the righteousness, but not the rightfulness of their opinions. Well, there's a lot more things that I could read here in regard to Jefferson, but one more from his grandson. This is the one I was looking for originally. He was regular in his attendance at church, taking his prayer book with him. He drew the plan of the Episcopal Church in Charlottesville, was one of the largest contributors to its erection, and contributed regularly to the support of its minister. I paid, after his death, his subscription of $200 to the erection of the Presbyterian Church in the same village. A gentleman of some distinction calling on him and expressing his disbelief in the truth of the Bible, his reply was, "Then, sir, you have studied it to little purpose." He was guilty of no profanity himself and did not tolerate it in others. He detested impiety. And his favorite quotation for his young friends as a basis for their morals was the 15th Psalm of David. He did not permit cards in his house. He knew no game of them. Well, there's a lot more we could say. That's enough, I guess, on Jefferson. Jefferson did not believe many of the basic doctrines of Christianity, but he seemed to have a high respect for them, especially as he grew later and older in life, because he seemed to feel that Christianity had a very beneficial effect on people in general. Now, as to John Adams, view was quite a bit different from Jefferson's. He was much more conservative in his view in that he did believe in divine revelation. He believed that God did inspire the writings of Scripture. Now, early in his life, Adams was raised in a Puritan home. He was a school teacher early in life, used the New England Primer in his teaching just like the others did, and wrote repeatedly of his belief in the miracles. He was very faithful in church attendance, and he said that he'd been a church-going animal for some 80 years and was not going to change now. Many, many fascinating statements that Adams makes about Christianity that are certainly worth your reading. But late in life, Adams began to question the doctrine of the Trinity, and partly this may be the result of his renewed correspondence with Jefferson. And the point Adams makes, however, as he's questioning the Trinity, is not questioning the truth of the Bible. He believed in the Bible, believed the Bible was the inspiration of God, although he questioned whether some of the things that are in the Bible were in the original text. But he questioned whether the Bible actually taught Trinitarian Christianity the way we believe it here. And as I'm saying this, let me be sure to emphasize to you, I believe in the Trinity. But I'm simply saying that Adams believed in divine revelation without necessarily believing in the Trinity. Some of the things that he says, looking for one comment particularly later in life, 1816, letter to Vanderkemp, he says, how could that nation Israel preserve its creed among the monstrous theologies of all the other nations of the earth? Religion, you will say, and especially providence. And I will not contradict you, for I cannot say with Dupuy that revelation is impossible or improbable. Christianity, you will say, was a fresh revelation. I will not deny this. As I understand the Christian religion, it was and is a revelation. I'm looking for a particular statement where he speaks about his belief in Christianity. I'll find this, I think, in just a minute here. Point of the matter is that John Adams may have questioned the Trinity, but he does appear very strongly to have... Oh, I think I know where that is. I'm not going to find the statement that I wanted to make here, but I'll kind of look for it as we take some other questions. Let's take some other questions, and then I'll get back to you on the statement of John Adams. Go ahead.
What influence does the book Lex Rex have upon American political thought?
The question about Lex Rex. Now, Lex Rex is a book by Samuel Rutherford. It's an excellent book dealing with the biblical position on law and government. And, of course, John Whitehead, author of the Rutherford Institute, has based much of his political philosophy on Lex Rex and has named his institute after Samuel Rutherford. As far as I can tell, in my own writings, and I probably read some 50,000 pages of the Founding Fathers' writings, I don't find very often where they themselves quote Rutherford and Lex Rex directly. But they do quote other sources that in turn are based on Lex Rex. In other words, many people, just like today, you don't find very many people quoting Spencer today. But they quote people who are influenced by Spencer. And it's the same way then, that John Locke in particular cites Rutherford quite a bit, and cites Hooker, who in turn is bases his thinking largely on Rutherford. John, can you abbreviate answers to your questions? Yes. Go ahead.
This is two. You can answer just one if you can. It's on a Bill of Rights. The first one is on the Sixth Amendment regarding being confronted by your witnesses against you. Regarding the trend that has recently occurred in child abuse cases or suspected child abuse cases where psychologists will interview a child through videotape, and they will use the videotape as evidence in court, and the accused is never confronted directly with the person against him, you know, the minor, young child. And it seems to me a very troubling development. And then a real quick one.
Let's take that question first, okay, so I don't forget it. Concerning the area of child abuse, I would very strongly recommend Mary Pride's book, The Child Abuse Industry, published by Crossley. It's very well done. The thing that I would stress there is that so much of what is being done in the interest of preventing child abuse is not only not helping children, but hurting families. And I think one of the real dangers here is the social worker mentality that exists today that just assumes that if you get a child into the loving custody of the state, that child is going to be okay. And I understand that thinking. I remember a case out of Chicago one time where a social worker was uncertain whether to take a child into custody, finally decided after thinking it over, agonizing over it, that she did not have quite enough grounds to do so, and so she was going to wait until the next week. Over the weekend, the child was thrown out of a three-story window and killed. You can imagine the type of dilemma that that social worker faced and what she must be thinking about that. Yet, the assumption that this child is going to be safe when it gets into the care of the state just simply doesn't follow. There are so many examples of abuse in child care institutions. In foster care, the rate of child abuse is more than double what it is in natural families. And, well, obviously, child abuse itself needs to be prosecuted and treated and or treated. We need to be careful of what we're doing. Really, one thing, too, I might mention. Most child abuse, I've seen studies indicating over 90% of it, takes place not by natural parents, but by extended families. That is, live-in boyfriends and uncles and stepfathers and things like that. What we really need most is getting back to the traditional family, because that's the institution God created for children, and that's what makes them most safe. Now let's get to your specific question, though. In regard to confronting accusers, I think there's a real danger there, and I'm hoping it's not going to go to the point where that can be done. Unfortunately, what often happens in these proceedings is that they choose to go other than a criminal proceeding. In other words, the right to confront an accuser is found in the Sixth Amendment, or the Fifth, is a criminal procedure right. Now, if instead of prosecuting you as a criminal for child abuse, if instead they decide to bring this as a proceeding in juvenile court, as a dependency or neglect matter, then those procedural guarantees may not apply. And so that's the way of getting around it. And that is, in my opinion, a very dangerous thing. Now, go ahead with your next question.
This is about the Fifth Amendment. What in the case that comes to mind is the case of Raymond Donovan, the former Secretary of Labor and civilian construction company that he was the vice president of. $20 million later and $3 million in publicity relations, on and on. Heavy expenses, and all four people that were indicted were acquitted, innocent. What other protections against the prosecutor and the grand jury in terms of the evidence? Every single point, it was not other people that looked at it says, I don't see how they could have called for this kind of thing. You know, his reputation is damaged. Is this just too bad, or what's your perspective on a tragedy like this?
Frankly, I'm not sure I have the answer, and you're right, it is a tragedy. Unfortunately, what can happen in our legal system is that if you are falsely accused of a crime, you can clear yourself and hopefully be successful, but in the process, lose your job, lose your life savings, your family, and everything else. Now, there's only a couple answers that I know for it, and one might be some type of a discipline that could be exercised toward a prosecutor in a situation like this, and where there's a clear abuse, there might be a possibility of doing so through an ethics complaint to the American Bar Association. Other possibilities might be to have the legal system provide. In fact, there are, I think, some states where, in a case where it's felt that a prosecution was frivolous, the judge may, at his discretion, award the defendant his attorney fees and other damages. That's not done very often, and you'll probably find a lot of taxpayer resistance to doing that. But it may be that all we can say is that is one of the things we have to live with in an imperfect system. Those are a few suggestions, but it is a tragedy. Go ahead.
Concerning the Genocide Treaty versus the Constitution, Senator Tom Foley had once said that it enhances the U.S. Constitution, and I'd like your opinion on that.
I have not studied the Genocide Treaty enough to say. I can't really see any way in which the Genocide Treaty enhances the United States Constitution. In fact, it would look to me, from what I've seen of the Genocide Treaty, and it's been a few years since I've read it, that portions of that treaty would open up such things as immigration and other features of American law to consider those possibly under the ramification of possible genocide, and therefore place them under the control of an international body. And I don't see that as enhancing our Constitution at all. I see that as undermining it. So without being able to comment more specifically about the Genocide Treaty, I think it's a tragic thing that has been apparently put into effect. Go ahead.
Yes. What significant changes, if any, came about under Supreme Court Justice John Marshall?
I'd say the two most significant changes would be the development of judicial review, that is, the articulation of the view that courts have the power to strike down acts of Congress as unconstitutional. That was a disputed point before, but not specifically denied necessarily. And secondly, the concept that the powers delegated to our federal government include implied powers as well as express power. I'd say those would be the two most significant. Go ahead.
You mentioned our founding fathers were concerned about individual rights for life, liberty, and property. And today we have local governments that are concerned about property rights as far as limitations such as zoning ordinances are created for that purpose. Were the founding fathers concerned with limiting the rights of property owners in order to protect the public's health, safety, and welfare? And if so, did they have any guidelines for evaluating when the public's safety, health, and welfare were being threatened?
Offhand, I wouldn't be able to tell you any specific guidelines that they had. Yes, they would have believed at that time that there were circumstances where public health and safety justified some type of restriction on property rights, but in general, they took a very high view of property rights. Very high view. Go ahead.
I have several quick questions. One, is there any possibility that Congress of the United States doing what happened in Nazi Germany when Hitler was in power, where the Reichstag basically abolished themselves and granted all of their authority to Hitler? Is there any possibility of the Congress doing that here?
Well, if it happened there, I suppose it could happen here. I think it's unlikely. One thing, we have a 200-year-old constitutional tradition, but I think there'd be a public outcry if that were to happen. The other thing, due to our party system and so on, I just have my doubts that our congressmen are so power-hungry as it is that they'd want to give their power to the executive branch. I just think their own self-interest would keep them from doing so. I can't see it as being a very likely thing, but again, I couldn't say it could never happen, I guess.
And the other questions are dealing with the Falwell and Flint case and then the recent Soldier of Fortune ad that is dealing with the murder that occurred through the hiring process?
Okay, here we're dealing with restrictions on the right of free speech. It's been quite a few years since I got a letter from Jerry Falwell, you know, the forum letter, in which he talked about what was in Hustler, was it Hustler magazine? Hustler magazine. And at that time, I was teaching constitutional law, in which I teach the subject of libel and slander, and it certainly looks to me like Hustler magazine had gone beyond the bounds of free speech and had gone into the area of clearly willful and reckless disregard of the truth and maligning the mother of a famous person. So I thought that verdict should have been upheld, and on the other hand, I'm not too surprised that it wasn't. The tendency that I've noticed recently is it seems like people who are famous people who are suing for libel have a strong success rates before juries, but very often those verdicts seem to be overturned by the higher courts. I think that was true with Carol Burnett and with National Enquirer and with quite a few others as well. I don't know. One of the things we do here, just so you understand what we're talking about here, we have a doctrine in law that is called the public person doctrine. Now, if you want to sue your next-door neighbor for libel, you simply have to prove that the statement that he made about you was false and that he made it negligently. Now, the fact that he read it in the newspaper or something like that, if it's a reliable newspaper, that might mean that he's free of negligence. On the other hand, if it's just a rumor he picked up out in the street corner somewhere and he went around spreading it without having checked it out for truth or falsehood, that should be negligence. On the other hand, if you're making a statement like that, let's say if you're a famous person and you want to sue for libel or slander, the court says that because you are a famous person, the public has a greater right to know about you, and there's a greater public interest in encouraging people to feel free to express opinions about you. And for that reason, if you are a public person, that is a person who either holds a high public office or are sufficiently in the public limelight for other reasons, you cannot sue somebody for libel unless you can show that that person knew the statement was false at the time he made it, or acted, made the statement, in willful and reckless disregard of the truth. In other words, there's a higher standard for a public person than for a private person, or a lower standard, depending on how you want to interpret it. And I have had some serious questions all along whether it's proper to have that distinction. Every time we do see a media source that gets sued successfully for libel, they claim that the First Amendment is in danger. Well, I don't think there's anything in danger about requiring people to tell the truth. And so I personally, I'm on the side of Falwell on that one. On the other one, we're dealing with a very different issue. This is an ad in Soldier of Fortune magazine. I just read about this a couple days ago, in which somebody had placed an ad expressing that he's willing to go on missions and so on. And somebody contacted him. They had an exchange, and as the person who made the initial contact initially suspected, the fellow who placed the ad was in fact a hitman. And so he made a deal with the hitman that the hitman would kill his wife. Isn't that the way it was? And anyway, I guess the real issue here is, from the wording of the ad, could Soldier of Fortune magazine, should they have known that this was the ad of a hitman? Reading over the ad itself, I wasn't quite sure whether they could tell that or not. But in a case where a magazine like that is able to determine that this ad is for illegal purposes, I don't think free speech covers it, and I think they constitute a co-conspirator in committing the crime. Go ahead.
Yes, in the war for independence, some people use the argument that the founding fathers weren't submissive to the king, using Romans 13, and could you shed some light on that?
Okay, the question that he's talking about is whether or not the American War for Independence was justified in light of Romans 13, which commands us to obey the civil authorities and says they are instituted of God. You notice I didn't speak about the American Revolution. I spoke about the American War for Independence. And there is a difference. I think a strong argument can be made that what happened in 1776 through 1783 was not a war, not a revolution at all. First of all, we're talking about a political body that is located a whole ocean away. Unlike the French Revolution, which was headed by a group of self-appointed leaders, we're talking about a nation, the United States of America, which had its regularly elected officials that led and conducted the war for independence. But there's another factor here, too, and that is, at that time, we're talking about English feudal law. Now, under English feudal law, you have what we call a vassal-servant relationship. I'm sorry, a lord-vassal relationship. In England at that time, during the feudal period, you would make a deal for protection with a lord because obviously you'd be overridden by bandits on your farm if you tried to stick it out alone. And so you make a deal with the lord, a local lord or baron, that he would provide you with protection. And in return, you would agree to give him taxes and military service. Well, we had the same vassal-lord relationship with England. But due to much of the controversy that was going on at the time, England broke the vassal-lord relationship by declaring, and I believe it was the Intolerable Act, I'd have to check which act specifically, but declaring in one of its acts in 1775 that the American colonies are removed from the protection of the king and are hereby declared to be treated as foreign enemies. Now, since England broke the lord-vassal relationship and ceased its obligations to us as lord, that meant that America's obligations to England as vassal were terminated. And if this sounds like legal sophistry, I can only say that the colonies argued this case extensively and that such members of the English Parliament as Sir Edmund Burke thoroughly agreed with that argument and said that the American colonies have a legal case for independence. We can point out several other factors to be considered here. One is that the colonial charters by which the American colonies were established almost universally gave those colonies autonomy in the conduct of their local affairs, which England tried to violate. Then there's a question as to whom America would owe allegiance. Do they owe allegiance, for example, to the king or to Parliament? Obviously not to Parliament, since in Parliament, the authority of Parliament extends only insofar as Parliament has representation, and the colonies had no representation in Parliament. That's where this saying, taxation without representation is tyranny, comes in. And as far as loyalty to the king, well, the earlier dynasty was, I'm trying to remember my history now, the Stuart kings were, of course, the ones who initiated the original colonial charters. So when the Stuart kings were overthrown, then how much responsibility was left on the part of the colonies to be loyal to the successor dynasty? It's hard to, there's some difficult questions there, but I think a strong argument can be made anyway that the colonies were independent, and that as Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence, not that we should be, or that we're going to fight in order to become, but these colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. So I think a strong argument can be made that this is a war for independence, not a revolution. And in that way, I would contrast it greatly from the French Revolution. Go ahead.
Yes, what were the causes that led up to the Constitutional Amendment? I believe it's the 17th that changed the senators from being not elected, but elected by the state government.
I don't really know what the history of the 17th Amendment was. I don't know why they decided they wanted to do it that way, but I would, just to give you a guess, I can only say that gradually from, at least from the Civil War period on to the present, there has been a gradual move away from making this a republic to indirect representatives and moving toward more direct democracy. And about the only answer I could give you right now would be that this is probably just one more step in that growing trend. But the specific facts leading up to that, I don't really know. Go ahead.
Okay, I have some short questions. The first one is on prayer in schools. Would the positive effect of prayer in school outweigh the negative results in the light of a Satan-worshipping chaplain now serving in our armed forces?
Okay, that's a good question. And it illustrates how religious freedom has to be a two-edged sword. Now, we can, in our public schools, leave them utterly devoid of any religious content whatsoever. Except we're not really even doing that. When that happens, what we've got is the establishment of secular humanism. But we could do that. On the other hand, in a pluralistic society such as ours, if we are going to open the public schools for Bible clubs and Youth for Christ and organizations like that, very probably we're going to have to open them to offbeat cults as well. I guess I prefer the idea of the free marketplace of ideas. And I think that Christianity can hold its own in the public schools if given equal access with others. Now, if we're concerned about cults making way, and I'm not so sure that's going to happen in most schools, I think that's a scare that's being placed in us by really the secular humanists, because I just don't see that happening in many schools. It could happen in some. But one way of getting around that problem would be to allow private clubs, you know, clubs like Campus Crusade and the Satanist Club and others to meet on campus, but to have a provision that no student may attend any meeting of any of these private clubs unless he has permission in writing from his parents. And that would preserve some form of parental authority to keep that sort of thing from happening. Go ahead.
My question concerns a very general approach to constitutional law issues. One of the things that I've always been taught or heard is that constitutional law is essentially a balancing test, where you're balancing a burden versus an interest. An example might be in the context of this discussion, the Wisconsin case, or no, it was the Amish and the buggies, and balancing the size of the burden versus the benefit to the state. That creates, at least to me, a very subjective gray area of law. Now, is that inherently inconsistent with a biblical view of constitutional law?
Okay, the question, do we have areas of gray in interpreting constitutional law, especially with some of these balancing tests? I would say, first of all, there are some things where there is no gray. And some areas of constitutional law, for example, in the deal with the discussion of free speech and so on, Justice Black would make the observation, no law abridging freedom of speech means no law. And then the only question comes in, what constitutes speech and what is outside of what the founders meant by speech? So we don't always have to use the balancing test. But in some cases, I think a balancing test and some gray area does become inevitable. And that's just some of the practical outworking of our Christianity. Sometimes what we believe in theory and how we can implement it sometimes are two different things. I hate to put it that way, but sometimes it is. And that raises the question, when are we compromising in politics? I'll answer you this way. As far as compromising in politics, if you have done all you can to promote your ideal, you're not compromising if you have to agree to something less than what you really wanted. Or what you think you really should have had. For example, let's say that, just give a classic situation here, let's suppose that you're proposing a bill, let's forget about Roe versus Wade a minute, and suppose that you're proposing a bill to make abortion illegal. And you know that you've got about, out of 100 votes in the Senate, you've got about 30 on your side, and about 70 that are going to vote against you. But you know also that if you included an exception in the bill for rape and incest, you know that you'd get an additional 40 votes. And then your bill would be almost assured of passage. But you personally are opposed to abortion, even in the case of rape or incest. But you know that in that case, probably about 99% of the babies would be saved because we're talking about a very small exception. Do you agree to that exception? Do you sacrifice that other 1% because of the 99% you're trying to save? Would you agree to allow that exception in there so you get a bill through when otherwise you'd have none? My answer again would be I'd go ahead with it. And I would say that if you have done all you can do to get the bill you want, accepting something less than that is not really a compromise. It's merely the realistic outworking of what you believe, knowing that eventually you'll come back and try to bring things about even more according to what you believe. I hope that helps some anyway. Go ahead, sir.
You mentioned something that I had never heard before, and that was that the Congress had the right to limit appellate jurisdiction for the Supreme Court. And this is of interest to me because my concept of how change can occur, I've been concerned about the assertion of power by the Supreme Court. And I was wondering if you could comment on what is the most practical way of working for change.
Working for change in the court? I would say several things. First of all, I would encourage you both at the state and federal level and the local level to work for the election and appointment of judges who believe in interpreting the Constitution as it is written and who believe in interpreting the Constitution in a philosophy of judicial restraint, that is, not consistently replacing their views with those of the legislature. I'd say there's another thing that deserves some careful thought, and that is possibly placing some limits on judicial review. One possibility that has been considered, which probably would require a constitutional amendment, would be to say that the Supreme Court may not declare an act of Congress unconstitutional unless, let's say, six judges concur in that ruling. In other words, it has to be a two-thirds vote before a statute is declared unconstitutional. That's just one thought. So those are a few things that could be done, but I would say, first of all, inform yourselves so that you can discuss these issues intelligently. Secondly, work for the selection of judges who share your judicial philosophy. There is one question that was given to me. I'll take that as soon as this gentleman is finished.
I have come across some articles and heard some statements that says Justice Thurgood Marshall says that the original Constitution was dead or is dead, and it's because of the 13th, 14th, 15th and 17th Amendments, and he bases his argument on the fact that all natural-born and equal and naturalized citizens are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Do you concur with that, or do you understand, or have you heard those kind of things before?
I heard a statement that Justice Marshall made sometime last summer, I believe it was, in which he cast some serious aspersions on the wisdom of the Founding Fathers, and said that they were not particularly men of great insight or character, and, well, criticized their stand on the slavery issue, which I can understand, but said many, many other derogatory things. I don't remember just saying these specific things. I would say it disturbed me a great deal what I heard, and I felt that he was coming dangerously close to violating his oath of office in which he swore to uphold the Constitution. There is one other question that was asked here that came in writing, and maybe I'll just mention this quickly. What is your opinion of the Reagan-appointed Supreme Court justices, O'Connor, Scalia, and Kennedy? Well, first of all, the only real contact I've had with Scalia is to read his dissenting opinion in the Aguilar case. That's the case involving creation and evolution, and I thought that was an absolutely brilliant opinion that he wrote there. So I have very high regard for Scalia. For O'Connor, I guess I'd have to say that I think she's done reasonably well. Her opinions seem very intelligent, very professional. As far as rating her on the scale of liberal or conservative, she is not as conservative as Rehnquist, nor as conservative as Scalia, I don't think. But generally seems to be siding with the conservative wing of the court. Kennedy, I'm optimistic about Kennedy, but again, there's just not very much that can be said. There aren't enough opinions that he's written in areas that are a concern to me that I can really say much about him. I did read in the Washington Times recently where one columnist reviewed several of his circuit court opinions and said that they thought that on religious freedom issues, he'd probably take a pretty conservative position, that is, moving away from the wall of separation position, but we don't really know enough to say for sure. I guess I'm optimistic about all three, particularly about Scalia. Rod, I'll turn it back over to you. Feedback from an institute like the one we just had on the Constitution can be very valuable sometimes. After this institute on the Constitution took place in March 1988, a lady said to me, "You know, I liked what you said. You had so many worthwhile things. But after it was over with, I felt so depressed. I felt like evolution, humanism, the liberals are taking over this country, totally controlling our thought. And what can we do?" It occurred to me that I probably hadn't done as much as I should to suggest solutions to the problem. So I'd like to present one supplementary message, and I'm going to title this message, Reclaiming Our Constitution, a 12-point plan for reclaiming the Constitution. Point one, educate the American people about the Constitution of the United States. There are studies which show that, unlike our founding fathers and unlike the common people in the early decades after our Constitution was written, people today are very ignorant about the Constitution. In fact, the Hearst Corporation conducted a study in the fall of 1986, interviewing 1,004 American adults. They discovered that 46% of the American people do not know that the purpose of the Constitution was to create a federal government and define its powers. 26% think the purpose of the Constitution was to declare independence from England. Only 34% know even approximately how many amendments have been approved to date. By the way, the answer is 26. Only 41% correctly identified the Bill of Rights as the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. In fact, 27% think the Bill of Rights is the preamble to the Constitution. So we have a great deal of ignorance about the Constitution in America today, and we need to educate Americans about the Constitution. One way of educating them is to arrange for the presentation of this seminar at churches, at civic groups across the land. Play these tapes, conduct them in your home, but I'm available. I'm available to present this seminar in churches and civic groups anywhere in the country. And you may contact me at 8759 South 129th East Avenue, Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, 74012, 918-254-1787. Point two. Not only should the people as a whole be educated in the Constitution, but we need to re-educate lawyers and law students in principles of biblical law. When I was in law school, I spent 2.5 years thinking I was probably the only Christian there. Toward my last semester, I discovered there was another fellow who thought he was the only Christian there. There was no such thing at the time as the Christian Legal Society, at least on our campus. But today we have things going like the Christian Legal Society, the Rutherford Institute, and other groups that are seeking to promote a Christian view of law and lawyering. Point three, take a firm stand for jurisprudence of original intent. You'll be ridiculed for this in some circles. It'll be said that original intent cannot be determined, but in fact it can in most cases. I've read about 50,000 pages of the Founding Fathers' writings, and I am convinced that their intent in most instances is readily determined, and at least it should be determined where it can be. Now, judicial interpretation, that is, jurisprudence of original intent, does not preclude flexibility in application. It has to do with learning the fundamental principles that the Founding Fathers wrote into the Constitution and adhering to those principles. It doesn't mean there can't be flexibility in the way those principles are applied. Not only that, but if change is necessary, the Constitution can and should be amended. Not misinterpreted and stretched beyond recognition, but rather interpreted as the Founders intended it. And if we don't like the way they intended it, if we don't think that can apply today, then we amend the Constitution. The Founders never thought the Constitution was on a par with the Bible, the Word of God. That's why they wrote into the Constitution itself a system for its own amendment. The Bible has no such system. Another point to be made, though. Original intent applies in every other field of law. Original intent applies in the way we interpret statutes. If the statute itself is unclear, we look to the legislative intent. And the Constitution is a statute. It is the supreme law of the land. We use original intent in interpreting contracts. If the contract isn't clear, we look to the intent of the parties. And the Constitution is a contract, a covenant. We use original intent in interpreting wills and trusts. If it's not quite clear what they mean, we look to what the maker of the will or trust would have intended. And again, the Constitution is a testamentary document between the founders and future generations. Is the Constitution entitled to be treated with any less respect than wills and trusts, or contracts, or ordinary laws? Millions of Americans swear to uphold the Constitution when they enter the armed forces or take public office. Can they be true to that oath if they don't interpret it as it says and as it's intended? Certainly, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. As such, it is entitled to greater deference than statutes, even greater deference than court decisions. And I think it's significant to note that even those who reject original intent nevertheless quote the framers when it suits their purposes to do so. Think, for example, about Jefferson's phrase about the wall of separation between church and state, and consider the extent to which our courts today cite that as original intent. They cite it out of context and without due regard to its importance, with undue regard to its importance, perhaps. But they certainly use original intent when they can use it to suit its purpose, their purposes. And finally, without original intent, there are no limits on judicial power. Judges are free, as Chancellor Kent said, to roam at large in the trackless fields of their own imaginations. They can read into the Constitution anything they want, good or bad. And they can read out of the Constitution anything they want, good or bad. If they can insert rights into the Constitution that the Founders didn't place there, they can just as easily take rights out of the Constitution that the Founders did place there. This has great potential for evil, and great potential for tyranny today. Point four, work for the election of or appointment of judges at all levels, local, municipal, district, county, state, federal, who believe in the jurisprudence of original intent, and for the most part, who believe in judicial restraint. Now, there are times when judicial review is necessary. In fact, it's sometimes strange that those of us who are conservative Christians, we sometimes say we're against judicial review, and yet If a legislature passes a law that unduly restricts Christian schools, we go right to the court and ask the court to exercise judicial review and strike that law down as violating the First Amendment. Judicial review is appropriate. Judicial usurpation is inappropriate. Where the courts go beyond the intent of the framers, where the courts go beyond their role of simply interpreting the statute and determining whether the statute is consistent with the Constitution as the framers intended it, when we go beyond that, we have judicial tyranny. And we need to work for judges who believe, by and large, in judicial restraint. Point five, work for the election of a president who recognizes his proper role in the constitutional system and who will appoint federal judges and justices who hold sound constitutional principles. This is probably the greatest work President Reagan has accomplished in his years of office. He has largely remade the Supreme Court by putting on three new conservative justices, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor, and elevated Rehnquist to the Chief Justice position. He's also made great changes in the Circuit Courts of Appeals and the Federal District Courts as well. That is probably his most important accomplishment, and we need a president who will follow this tradition and appoint judges who believe in judicial restraint and original intent, instead of appointing judges who will follow the philosophy of the American Civil Liberties Union. We need to work to bring Congress back to sound constitutional principles. Begin with your congressmen and your senators. Is their thinking in accord with the biblical principles of government found in the Word of God? Are they constitutionalists who believe in the limited scope of government that the Constitution provides? Work to re-elect them if their thinking is sound. Work to replace them if it is not. Point seven, we need to resist the growth of administrative law. All these administrative agencies, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, the IRS, the Social Security Administration, these many other departments that are practically a law unto themselves, departments that can interpret the law as they see fit, and virtually unaccountable even to the President of the United States. Much of what goes on in administrative law today is, in my opinion, unconstitutional. It violates the concept of separation of powers. It violates the doctrine of non-delegation of powers. Congress should be making the laws in our domestic front, not administrative agencies. And we need to rein these administrative agencies under control. They are becoming the most powerful instruments of government, except maybe for the Supreme Court. And Congress, at least in domestic life, has become too weak. You know, it's really a strange thing the way our Congress is functioning today. A liberal-controlled Congress today would seek to restrain the President in foreign affairs and usurp authority in foreign affairs that belongs to the President, but would seek to abdicate its authority in domestic affairs. That's not the concept of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers believed that the President should have widespread authority in domestic affairs. Read especially the Federalist Papers and especially the writings of John Jay. The role of Congress in foreign affairs was largely one of oversight. But in domestic affairs, Congress is supreme. Congress today has it all turned around. Point eight, cut down the size of government, even if your pet programs are affected. When George Washington took office in 1789, we had a total of 350 federal civilian employees, and they were able to govern our nation simply because the federal government at that time largely kept out of the people's affairs. Today we have 4.2 million federal civilian employees, each of them governing some aspect of our lives. More federal employees today than we had people in 1789, and the ratio has increased dramatically. We need to cut down the size of government. And sometimes that hurts, but it needs to be done. Now, in accordance with Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, I think we should support efforts to limit the federal court's appellate jurisdiction over such matters as abortion. Now, I remember bringing this out at the platform committee of the Republican Party a few months ago here in Oklahoma, and I was vociferously opposed by several people there saying that was unconstitutional, and I was tampering with the Constitution. Not at all. That is a check on judicial power that the Founding Fathers wrote into the Constitution. Article 3, Section 2 provides that the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction over certain specific things and appellate jurisdiction over all other areas subject to such limitations as Congress may from time to time impose. In other words, Congress has this authority under Article 3, Section 2 to limit the Supreme Court or the federal courts in general with their appellate jurisdiction. They should do so from time to time. In fact, this check was a check the Founding Fathers placed in the Constitution to prevent judicial tyranny. And it was used rather frequently in the early years of our republic, but it's largely been forgotten today. Read over Article 3, Section 2, and let's apply it. Point 10. There are certain amendments to our Constitution that are desperately needed today. Let me suggest several. First of all, I would support an amendment calling for specific procedures in the event a new constitutional convention is called, as provided in Article 5, so that a new convention does not become a runaway that goes beyond its original purpose and endangers our constitutional system of government. You see, we're in danger today. 32 of the necessary 34 states have called for a new constitutional convention. And if that convention takes place, there is no guarantee in the Constitution as to what limits will be placed upon it, as to what it could do. There is nothing to prevent it from being a runaway convention controlled by liberal pressure groups that could use it to write a whole new constitution for the United States. And there are several new constitutions waiting in the wings today. We need to be very careful of this. And my suggestion is to amend Article 5 using the normal route, the route we've used 26 times, two-thirds of both houses of Congress, subject to ratification by three-fourths of the states, in which we provide certain procedures in the event of a constitutional convention. And if that is done, then this could be a good safety valve against the inaction of Congress. Another amendment that I would support, an amendment declaring that the Constitution shall be interpreted strictly according to the intent of the framers. Now, how effective that amendment would be, I honestly don't know, because obviously the same court that is interpreting the Constitution today will interpret that amendment, and they might interpret it all wrong. But at least it would be a statement of intent. I would favor a constitutional amendment to restore constitutional rights, such as the right to life, to unborn children, starting at the point of conception. The Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade gave a travesty on justice. It's one of the most poorly worded decisions ever written. And yet, today, that decision is the law of the land. An amendment is necessary. D. An amendment provided that the power granted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8 to regulate interstate commerce shall not include the power to regulate intrastate commerce or manufacturing or production. You recall that Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states. Well, originally we thought that meant that commerce within a state was outside Congress jurisdiction. But they've gone beyond that. This amendment would make it clear. I would support an amendment providing that the power granted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8 to tax for the general welfare shall not include the power to tax for the specific welfare of individuals or groups. It used to be that this was thought to be a limitation. They could tax only for the general welfare, not for the specific welfare of individuals or groups. But now we say that if a subsidy is given to the milk industry, well, dairy farmers are going to use that subsidy to buy things for themselves, and that'll stimulate the economy in general. After all, no man is an island, and so the distinction between general and specific welfare has been virtually obliterated, just as has the distinction between interstate and intrastate commerce. We need to restore that distinction. And there are a couple other amendments that would be worthy of consideration, although I do not necessarily endorse them. One would be an amendment limiting the terms of federal judges to a fixed number of years, and or providing that federal judges shall be subject to periodical recall by election. There are arguments in favor of this. It would provide, it would limit judicial power. It would make judges more responsive to the will of the people. But personally, I think the arguments against are probably stronger. It would politicize the judiciary. It would cause judges to make decisions based on how a decision would affect their re-election or reappointment, rather than on the basis of what is right. If I am on trial, or if a member of my family is on trial, I don't want the judge making that decision based on how it's going to affect his chances for re-election or reappointment. There are dangers in the insulation of the judiciary as we have it today, But on the whole, I favor their independence. Another amendment, one that would provide that the Supreme Court may not declare an act of Congress unconstitutional unless at least two-thirds of the justices concur. And I can see considerable merit in this, although I'm not ready to endorse it yet at this time. Point 11, stand up for your constitutional rights. Don't let them atrophy or weaken or die away for lack of use. And that's especially true with your right to religious liberty. You know, it's been said that, let's suppose I were to speak for 10 hours today, and somebody got so sick of listening to me that that person had a heart attack and died. And so as a result, Congress was so offended at this, they got together and passed a law saying from now on, no one may speak longer than 5 hours, no one may preach longer than 5 hours at a time. Would you object to a law like that? Maybe not, because you don't like that kind of preaching. You don't like people to preach for 5 hours at a time. But if you accept that law, you have just accepted the premise that government has the right to regulate the length of preaching. And if government can regulate the length of preaching, why not the time and place of preaching? And then why not the content of preaching as well? The point is this. Freedom is one ball of wax. A seemingly innocent threat to one aspect of our religious freedom may be used as a precedent to damage religious freedom in general. And that's especially true when government chooses an unpopular religious group to pick on. It then sets a precedent by which to go after the rest of us. So we need to be very careful there. The First Amendment means the government may not show preference for one religion over another. It does not mean religion has no place in public schools or public life. The Christian has the same right to free expression of his religious views in the public arena as has anyone else. Don't let the American Civil Liberties Union or any other radical separationist groups deprive you of this right. And finally, I would urge you, pray for the United States of America and its legal system, and pray for freedom-loving peoples everywhere. Pastor Richard Wurmbrand, a Lutheran minister who spent 14 years in communist prisons in Romania, put it this way, every freedom-loving man has two fatherlands. His own and America. Today, America is the hope of every enslaved man because it is the last bastion of freedom in the world. Only America has the power and spiritual resources to stand as a barrier between militant communism and the peoples of the world. It is the last dike holding back the rampaging floodwaters of militant communism. If it crumbles, there is no other dike, no other dam, no other line of defense to fall back upon. America is the last hope of millions of enslaved peoples. They look to it as their second fatherland. In it lies their hopes and prayers. I have seen fellow prisoners in communist prisons beaten, tortured, with 50 pounds of chains on their legs, praying for America, that the dike will not crumble, that it will remain free. Fellow Americans, let us do our part to ensure that the dike does not crumble. Let us do our part to strengthen it, to uphold it, to repair it where it is giving way. For as we read in Psalm 11:3, if the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? Thank you, and may God bless you.